Estás escuchando Fun Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughn Radio. Now, on this program, I'm going to talk about fake news. Fake news is in the news today. Everybody talks about the possibility that what you are listening to might be entirely fabricated. And whether there is any guarantee of authenticity in what people are hearing, because as we have more exposure to different kinds, different sources of news, we tend to edit the news, or the news tends to be edited for us, because there are algorithms that our computers use to give us the kind of news we want to hear and that we want to respond to. And this only tends to confirm our own prejudices, our own bias. And so we are less and less likely to hear points of view or genuine news about events that contradict our own view of the world, so that people become more and more set in their opinions, and it is less and less common to hear contradictory arguments. And when you do hear contradiction, it's generally not in the form of an argument. It's in the form of shouting, screaming, violence. Because the art of the debate, the art of rhetoric, persuasive speech, is not taught anymore. It's fallen out of use. Perhaps on a later series of programs, I could speak about the basics of classical rhetoric and how that could be adapted to our times, how to make a persuasive speech, what the ancients used to use. For example, the triple use of logos, ethos, and pathos that all of the great classical rhetoricians recommended. Logos, of course, being the arguments that you're going to use, the facts that you're going to use. And make sure that they are verifiable. Make sure that they really happened. Ethos involves knowing who your audience is, where they are coming from, what they expect to hear. If you tell them something, even if that thing is true, if you tell them something they are not prepared to believe, then they will not believe you. And so you have to take that into account. You cannot give them an argument that they are not prepared to hear. The second part of ethos is that you must appeal to them. You must demonstrate to them that you know what you're talking about. So, for example, a salesperson, when you want somebody to buy a product and you are giving a speech or you're giving some kind of presentation in order to sell the product, then you don't want to go too far into detail. What you want them to do is to trust you. It's 90% the person and only 10% the product that they are buying. If you say that this is the very best product on the market, then that's good enough for them, as long as they trust you. As long as they believe that you know what you're talking about. Which, of course, means quite a bit of self-confidence. In any case, that would be the side of ethos. Logos, ethos, and pathos. Logos, the argument itself, the reasons behind the argument. Taking your opponent's argument into account and giving a counter argument. I know that you might think this, but the fact is that, you know, all of this, logos, ethos, convincing them that you know what you're talking about and that you know who they are. This is not just an anonymous reader, an anonymous listener. In a presentation, you know who these people are. And pathos, something to make them feel, something to make them understand that this is important. It's important to you. It's important to them. It will make a difference. If you are able to give a speech or a presentation or present an argument with pathos, then the people listening to you will walk out inspired. It will be a call to action. They will exhibit the kind of behavior that you want to elicit in them, either buying the product or voting the way that you want them to vote or manning the barricade. All of these are part of pathos. Another part of pathos, the opposite part of pathos, is humor, making jokes. If you make jokes, if your audience begins to laugh and you laugh and you're enjoying yourself, having fun, then you are able to build a bridge with your audience. Humor is the closest link between two people, right? A joke is like a straight line between two people. They can laugh with each other and there's a real connection when you laugh. But at the same time, in terms of pathos, laughing will simply, it will not get them to move at all. It will not inspire them. It will take away any desire to act on what they're hearing. So yeah, they won't buy the product. They won't vote the way you want them to vote. They will not go out and protest. No. If it's too funny, after a good laugh, everybody feels so satisfied that nothing more is necessary. And so, if you believe that your opponent is making too good an argument, then you need to use humor to deflect that argument. In any case, this is just an overview of what I really should talk about on another program, about the classical approach to rhetoric, with, you know, the classical rhetoricians, Aristotle and so forth. Perhaps I will do that. In any case, today I'm going to talk about fake news, and I'm going to talk about fake news in the 19th century. And I am going to go back to my native California, San Francisco, to talk about it. There's nothing I like to talk about better than the Patria Chica, than where I'm from, San Francisco. And that often involves the gold rush. So yes, 1848, just what, 2 weeks after the signing of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, in which Mexico gave California, sold California, was forced to sell California to the United States. And gold is discovered. Captain John Souter had done all sorts of things to try and make money. And he set up a mill, right, molino. He set up a water mill on the American River near what is today Sacramento, in an area that really hadn't been discovered. The American River, almost where it comes into the Great Sacramento River, and all of these rivers go through the Central Valley of the United States, of California, the Central Valley of California, which at one point had been a sea. At one point, it had been, you know, covered in water. At another point, it had been a lake. And it's absolutely flat, unbelievably flat. In any case, here, where the American River comes into the Sacramento River, you have Souter and his mill. By the way, Souter got some of the construction. Wasn't very easy at the time to get boards and wood and all of the building materials you need. Because you have to, first of all, you need a sawmill, right? Un cerradero, right? To make the boards, right? There's tablas de madera. You need the sierra, the saw. You need to have a sawmill. You need to have that water. You need to have, but then you have to have a building before you even begin to saw that wood. And so what he needed was a pre-built materials. He needed to disassemble something that already existed. What he did was he purchased the pretty much abandoned at that point, the old Russian fort, because the Russians had gone down. They had penetrated down from Alaska onto the coast, Fort Ross. They had an enclave, a Russian enclave in Northern California, just about 70 miles north of what is today San Francisco. And this is why the Spanish were so upset about the possibility of this land going to Russia that the Spanish, well, especially the Spanish administrator, El Visitador, Galvez, right? José Galvez, he ordered Junipero Serra to go, who was a Franciscan priest, to go from Baja California to Alta California and set up a series of missions in Alta California. This was a geopolitical strategy. This was not missionary work. This is not evangelization of the Indians. No, this is geopolitics. In order to stop Russian penetration, Russian encroachment, the Spanish located their missions. And there were very polite, cordial relations between the Russians and the Spaniards. But then again, by 1821, Mexico gained its independence, and so this was all Mexican. And in Mexican times, the Russians left. And so all of that wood in that fort was abandoned. And it was the fort, Fort Ross, it's called today. It has been reproduced. It's a very, very interesting place to visit. And it's so beautiful up there. The area north of California. There's a town there called Mendocino, which is one of the most beautiful and you can possibly imagine. If you've ever seen Al Este del Edén, no, the adaptation of the book by Steinbeck, directed, if I remember correctly, by Ford. In any case, with James Dean in it, East of Eden was filmed there. And just incredible town. And, of course, Mendocino, California, because of the Mendoza family. Right? The Duques Infantado, the Mendoza family, who they had been viceroys, they had been adelantados, they had been administrators. They'd been very, very highly connected to the royal family for generations. And so it was natural to name a place after the Mendozas, like in Argentina. And in this case, Mendocino, California. Anyway, near Mendocino, California, you do have Fort Ross. And it was Fort Ross where John Sutter, got the wood to build his mill. And there, one of his lieutenants found gold in the American River. And you can imagine the gold rush. The gold rush of 1849, which is why in California everything is 49. 49 this, 49 that. The 49ers, the team. Yeah, it's just one of many instances where you go, anywhere you go in California, you will see the number 49. Because that was the year of the gold rush. So, I'm a minor 49er. The miners, people who came in, people like Levi Strauss, who used the sails from ships. Many, many, many more ships were coming than were leaving. Many ships were simply abandoned in the harbor in San Francisco. And there, they were used to expand the city of San Francisco. Much of the city of San Francisco was built over the detritus, over the garbage, over the over what was left, you know, of the demolition of those that were arriving. And so you can imagine what happened, that this place is seismically sensitive. So you can imagine in the earthquake in 1906, all of that fell into the sea. There was liquefaction, and much of the city was reduced to escombros, right, to rubble. And much of the rubble was then again pushed into the sea to expand the city even more. So that if and when there is another large earthquake, the big one, Much of the city will be vulnerable to that because it is built on unstable foundations. It is built on the los escombros, the rubble of the previous earthquake, the demolition of the city and the burning of the city. Well, this was long before that, when San Francisco was still young and rough and ready. And there were saloons and banks and cowboys. And as I say, levies, no? Tejanos, the Levi's, they were invented there for miners. And then you got journalists, and many of the journalists that came out there to see, to write, many of the journalists, some of the best prose that we have, new American prose with more vitality, with a different use of language, very, very different from what people were writing in England at the time. And then people like Mark Twain, Bret Hart, people out there. And then you had Henry Vizzitelli. Henry Vizzitelli, who had been born in 1820, and so at this time was 28 years old. He was a journalist and the perfect man to talk about the gold rush, to talk about California. He had to get there quickly because in a news cycle, you have fresh news, and then after a while, the news becomes stale. Stale means pasado, no? Pan seca, pan antigua, that's stale bread. Cerveza sin burbujas, cerveza muerta, that's stale beer. So that news also gets stale very, very quickly. And so, Vizzitelli had to do all of this in lightning time. Go from London, where he was based, to New York, to California, either around Cape Horn, at the southernmost part of South America, or crossing over the Isthmus of Panama, and or covering in, you know, in covered wagons, or across the Great Desert in the United States, but all of that was impractical, and he was so worried that by the time he got to San Francisco, San Francisco would no longer be news. So what he did was to fake his trip to California. He published one of the very first guidebooks to California without ever having visited there. He called it 4 Months Among the Gold Finders in California, being the diary of an expedition from San Francisco to the gold districts. All written in first person, all written in the most exciting prose. So yes, he said, it is the result of actual experience. But naturally, he must have spent all of his time in the British Library, or, you know, trying to, or maybe he just invented everything he wrote. In any case, in London, it sold very well. And it got rave reviews. The public loved it, and it was translated and read throughout Europe. So yeah, the German translator, the one in charge of putting this 4 Months Among the Gold Finders, putting that into German, translating that into German. He was so inspired by this book that he left Germany. After the translation was completed, he left Germany and went to California himself. That is how how that is the kind of impact that this book was capable of achieving. But it was all fake. All right, I have to take a break. I'll be back in a couple of minutes with the second part of the program.
As you know, every other Monday I offer a 90-minute masterclass in English from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Because so many people are coming now to my masterclass, I have needed to find a larger venue. So on Monday, the 30th of September, we will try a new venue.
Este lunes 30 de septiembre a las 7 de la tarde, no te pierdas la masterclass gratuita que ofrece Richard Vaughan. Te esperamos en el Salón de Plenos del Centro Sociocultural Clara Campoamor, en la Plaza Daoiz y Velarde número 2, Metro Pacífico. Entrada libre y gratuita. No faltes, te esperamos este lunes a las 7 de la tarde en la masterclass de Richard Vaughan en el Salón de Plenos del Centro Sociocultural Clara Campoamor, Plaza Daoiz y Velarde número 2, Metro Pacífico.
Join me at 7 p.m. Monday, the 30th September, for 90 minutes of dynamic and stimulating English. And let's decide together if this new venue is suitable for the future.
Dale un empujón a tu carrera profesional. Apúntate al Executive Master en Inglés Profesional de Vaughan. Aprenderás a negociar, a hacer presentaciones y a controlar cualquier situación profesional en inglés. Apúntate ya llamando al 91-133-5833 o entra en grupovaughan.com.
Ven a hacer tu prueba de nivel. Sin compromiso, tu prueba de nivel gratis. Llámanos 91-133-5833.
Manolito, sal del coche, que hasta las 5 no tienes clase de inglés, hombre, y son las 3. Manolito, que salgas del coche, te he dicho.
Tus hijos adorarán la vuelta al cole si los apuntas al Club Junior de Vaughan. Clases divertidísimas con los mejores profes de inglés para niños y jóvenes de 4 a 17 años. Apúntalos ya en el 91-133-5832 o en grupovaughan.com.
Vaughan y Disney presentan
Disney English Vaughan.
La magia de Disney en sus clases de inglés.
Ahora en Vaughan tus peques pueden aprender inglés con sus personajes favoritos Disney en un entorno creativo y lleno de diversión y aventura.
Historias interactivas, canciones, juegos y mucho más.
Con Disney English Vaughan aprenderán inglés sin darse cuenta de la mano de los mejores profesores.
Con Disney English y Vaughan llegarán hasta el infinito y más allá.
Disney English Vaughan está disponible en varias ciudades de España.
Para niños y niñas de 4 a 9 años.
Búscalo en grupovaughan.com y apúntalos ya.
Si tiene hijos recién licenciados o en su último año de carrera, asegúrese de que resuelvan, ahora que pueden, su dominio del inglés. Es importante quitar este problema de en medio ahora, antes de que entren en el mercado laboral. Si no, lo más probable es que nunca lo resuelvan.
Sí, sí, ya lo solucionaré. Decimos eso constantemente. Llámenos 911-33-5833. 911-33-5833.
Con nuestro MIP, nuestro Máster en Inglés Profesional, resolverás de por vida tu preocupación por el inglés. Podrás desenvolverte sin problemas. Quita de en medio el inglés ahora, en cuanto puedas. El Máster en Inglés Profesional de Vaughan.
Ven a conocer el método Vaughan. Invertimos todo nuestro esfuerzo en encontrar y formar a los mejores docentes.
listening to Vaughn Radio.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host, my name is Guy Williams, and you are listening to Vaughn Radio. Now, on the first part of the program, I was talking about fake news and one of its iterations in the 19th century. A man named Vizetelli, who was a journalist living in London, who simply invented a very, very popular guidebook to California during the time of the gold rush. He decided it just wasn't worth his while to make his way all the way out to California and that he could just invent something. As I say, it was wildly popular in England and widely translated into other languages. And toward the end of the first half of the program, I was talking about the German translator. The German translator was so impressed by this guidebook that he felt inspired to go to California himself. On the other hand, once he was in California, all of a sudden he began to face the discrepancies between what the book said and what was actually true. So, for example, one of the places he made sure to visit was the mill of John Sutter, Sutter's Mill in Sacramento on the American River. And there, he confronted Sutter, he talked to Sutter, and talked to Sutter about Sutter and about Vizetelli, and Sutter said, no, I don't know any Vizetelli. And he said, yes, he was here last year, and Sutter said, no, at that time I wasn't here. At that time I was in Europe. And all of these, again, a series of discrepancies that made him doubt. In one of the passages of the book, they talk about the Indian massacre, a great Indian massacre, and how the Indians practiced that very brutal thing of scalping, right? Taking the cuero cabelludo, right? Cutting it and removing it from the victim. The victim might be alive. I mean, it's possible to survive a scalping, or a scalping can kill you, but quite often it would simply mean that they would kill you and then scalp you, or scalp you, then kill you. But the scalp itself, which means cuero cabelludo, right? You can buy a shampoo that is good for your scalp. Well, the scalping was proof that you had conquered or killed your victim. So it was a trophy. And historians debate whether this was a custom of the indigenous peoples or whether it was actually taught to them by Europeans. Because way back in the middle of the 18th century, when the English and the French were at war, that war extended into the New World, and all of a sudden you had a war por terceros, no, por representantes, a proxy war. That's what we call it. Proxy. Your proxy is tu representante, la persona que, for example, if you have a comunidad de vecinos, no? And you cannot attend the meeting of the comunidad. Maybe you can give your vote to your neighbor. And so the neighbor becomes your proxy. And this is the way it's used in English. And in politics, in war, we talk about a proxy war. So that during the time of the Cold War, you would have two countries fighting each other, but one side would be supported by the United States and another side supported by the Soviet Union. Back in the middle of the 18th century, you could have a proxy war between Indian tribes, but one side would be supported by the British and the other by the French. Or the allies, the Indian allies, the indigenous allies of one of these two powers could attack settlements so that, again, French or English. And they say that during the French and English conflict, what we call the French and Indian War, they paid many of the warriors according to how many scalps, enemy scalps, they brought. The scalp was proof of death. And so many scalps in exchange for so much money. In other words, there exists a possibility that this entire custom of scalping was actually adopted from Europe. The fact is that what I'm talking about all took place on the east coast of the United States, near the settlements, near the colonies of the French and the English, on the Atlantic. And so this scalping continued, yes, there was scalping in the center of the United States, maybe during the Indian Wars, after the American Civil War, right? The great Indian Wars in places like South Dakota in the 1880s and 90s, maybe, yeah, but never California. I'm sorry, never, ever California. Indian massacres in California? No. There were hostile tribes, brutal tribes, the Apache, for example, the Comanche, but not in California. No, the Californian Indians weren't like that. The Spaniards who founded the missions in California, Junipero Serra and the Franciscan missionaries, they never found an organized resistance. There were really no hostiles, no hostilities there. So that it was quite obvious that Vizzitelli with his descriptions of horrific Indian massacres and scalpings, was inventing. And so the translator discovered that all of the book was simply fiction. That Vizzitelli was an imposter. And this was fake news. Now, Vizzitelli himself was a strange character. His own diary is filled with fabrications. His diary is a mixture of genuine events and imaginary events. And, perhaps he never really was able to distinguish between fact and fiction. But still, it doesn't explain his lack of scruples, I suppose, in publishing something so untrue. He lived as, you know, a kind of a bottom feeder, one of the very everything he wrote was published in illustrated books, magazines, inexpensive, ephemeral, and without any pretensions of literary merit. And so, yeah. The Vizzitelli was laughing all his way to the bank because he did make a large amount of money from this. In other words, fake news pays. Fake news is lucrative. You can make a lot of money from fake news, or at least that is the conclusion that you should be able to draw from the life of Henry Vizzitelli. Again, there are so many people who invent stories for themselves. Los fantasiosos, right? They start talking about things they've seen, things they've done. And at first you might think they're exaggerating, but in the end you know that they're simply making it up. That's one of the phrasal verbs that mean to invent, right? Inventar historias, historias que no son ciertas, no? That to make something up. So, yeah. Where did you get that statistic? Well, I just made it up. Now, I'm thinking right now of a quote by Oscar Wilde talking about his diary. He said, "I always take my diary with me everywhere I go because one must have something thrilling, no, emocionante, one must have something thrilling to read on the train." So yes, reading his own diary, he considered that to be thrilling, or at least he wanted other people to think that reading his diary is thrilling. Well, yeah, for the great majority of us, the only way that your diary will ever be thrilling is if you start making things up. That same year, there was another similar sort of fraud, in this case in New York, Hydesville, New York. In the home of John Fox, John and his wife Margaret, they started hearing things, hearing strange noises, things that go bump in the night, and they immediately looked for spirits, ghosts, things, supernatural things, things from beyond the grave, because at that time, belief in this sort of thing was very, very common. 40 years later, his daughters confessed that they had made these noises. These girls were very, very young, but they could still make noises with the joints, no, articulaciones, the joints of their toes, dedos de pie. So they could crack their toe. Crack, crack. There are people who can do that. Usually older people, but in this case, little girls. Little girls that could crack their fingers and crack their toes. And the result sounded strange. And so the noises began as soon as the family lay down to sleep. And the first one up was Mrs. Fox, the mother, Margaret. She asked if this was a spirit, and the crack, you could hear the yes. And she asked the spirit to answer questions, and one crack and two cracks. And the spirit was able to tell the story. Now, the story in this case was that one of the people they had staying with them, well, one of the people that earlier had stayed with them, a boarder, right? This was kind of a casa de huéspedes. It was kind of a boarding house, lodging house, that this boarder had murdered a traveling salesman. And so they convinced their mother, these little girls convinced their mother that what she was hearing was from beyond the grave. The soul of this traveling salesman who wanted justice. So, the fact is that they publicized this. Some of the neighbors went out and started digging for the body. There were false accusations. I mean, this man actually existed, and his life was now, he was under the suspicion of having murdered somebody. Now, people were suspicious of news from beyond the grave. And so, one of the relatives of the man who had been accused, a man named Bell, his older sister, learned what was going on, investigated on her own. She was able to question the girls. And the fact is that she could very quickly learn how to make those noises herself. She had also been given the capability of making these strange noises with the articulaciones, with the joints of her fingers and her toes. Now, she started to publicize this. She started to charge money for espiritismo, for these seances, for the connections of the dead. And this idea of communication with the dead, there was so much suspicion, so much skepticism about this, that people were watching. observing. People were watching them, watching their clothes. The examiners who were there during the session, during the seance, they really didn't find anything to, you know, there was no proof, no definitive conclusions. And of course, many, many people wanted to believe. At this time, there were all kinds of experiments in a new kind of spirituality and new possibilities of connecting with people from beyond the grave. And so, again, philosophy, religion, science, all of that expanding, and in the minds of many people, many, many people wanted it all to converge in something. This innate need that many people have to believe in something. And so, yeah, these girls, and at that point, these girls were in it too deep to be able to say no. When, in the end, they began to confess, first they told their publisher, and the publisher decided that this was going to be the end of spiritualism. When it all came out, the girls were discredited. But of course, the idea lived on. The Fox sisters, whom everybody had thought was the real thing, the Fox sisters had opened the door, because so many people really wanted to believe in this, that and when it turned out that the Fox sisters were frauds, people really didn't want to stop believing. So yes, they looked somewhere else. One of the interesting coincidences at that time is the fact that precisely then, they were beginning to have the capability of communicating at long distance through the telegraph. And it was precisely at this time that this series of knockings, this series of clickings, this noise had all been brought together by Samuel Morse in his famous Morse code, no? Morse, Código Morse. And this was simultaneous with what the Fox sisters were doing. The fact is that experiments at the time on magnetism and electricity and very, very strange things, like the fact that, for example, when you submit a dead piece of meat to electricity, that the muscle will contract. All of these things the possibility of using electricity to bring life to the dead, like in Frankenstein. All of this was very much alive then. And so, yes, there were many believers. And the neighbors, they dug up the house. They looked in the basement. And, yes, there were human bones in the basement. But nobody knows why. Not many. But, yes, there were human bones in the basement. And 50 years later, people tried again to look for those same bones, and they found more bones, but again,
The sisters had confessed. It was the sisters. This was a fraud. All right. I've run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please, listen to my next program.
Este lunes 30 de septiembre a las 7 de la tarde, no te pierdas la masterclass gratuita que ofrece Richard Vaughan. Te esperamos en el Salón de Plenos del Centro Sociocultural Clara Campoamor, en la Plaza Daoíz y Velarde número 2, Metro Pacífico. Entrada libre y gratuita. No faltes, te esperamos este lunes a las 7 de la tarde en la masterclass de Richard Vaughan en el Salón de Plenos del Centro Sociocultural Clara Campoamor, Plaza Daoíz y Velarde número 2, Metro Pacífico.
Join me at 7 p.m. Monday, the 30th September, for 90 minutes of dynamic and stimulating English. And let's decide together if this new venue is suitable for the future.
El Máster es el curso más importante, más exigente y más intensivo que hacemos aquí en Bauman Systems. Cada persona invierte una cantidad de dinero y tiempo para hacer el curso, y es muy importante para nosotros que cada persona termine el curso con el mejor nivel posible. Nuestros másteres son para todo el mundo.